Because one of the folks in the band pointed out this morning, the problem with Sunday mornings is that they fall on Saturday night. And I feel especially delighted to see you all here the morning after St. Patty's Day. I trust you all followed the parade all the way to the bar and celebrated and came to church anyway. You are awesome. I've been involved in what I guess you could call, I don't even like the words, but I think we mostly know what they mean in a community like this. I've been involved in ministry leadership most of my adult life. And I've had occasion to learn a few things. Some of the things that I've learned, I wanted to learn and set out to learn. Some of the things I've learned, I learned because I had to or because I failed, sometimes egregiously. One of the things that I have learned and continue to learn is that I have a lot to learn. But when I add it up, sometimes I think about even my role in this community and the stage of life that I'm at, and I feel like I should have something to offer by now as a leader. And sometimes in that process, I start to think that what I know, that the lessons that I've learned that help me to be in control as a leader, are the things that really matter, the big L leadership, out in front of the troops with the flag kind of leadership, that's the really important stuff. But then I come to a story like the one that we're going to look at today, and I get reminded that the world that Jesus called the kingdom of God really is kind of upside down and backwards to our prevailing culture, including our culture of leadership. And that's an important, and it seems like always timely, reminder for me. Unless you haven't been part of the gathering of this community before and you're a guest or you've been away a bit, let me just mention that we've been engaging the season of Lent in a few different ways, but one of them has been an examination of the three temptations of Jesus. The 40 days story that gives Lent its chronological shape to this day in our practice. And our story today, our text today, is the story of the third temptation, as we find it in Matthew. And this is the text. This is what Matthew tells us about that event. Again, the devil took Jesus to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. "All this I will give you," he said, "if you will bow down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, 'Worship the Lord your God and serve him only.'" Then the devil left him, and angels came and attended him. When I look back on the trajectory of my ministry experiences, one way to characterize them is that they've been moving from more predictable environments to less predictable environments as the years have gone by. And along with that movement has come exposure to more and more just plain raw pain in people's lives. And one of the byproducts of the exposure to raw pain for me has been the growing realization that what I thought mattered the most in ministry and in the rest of life actually doesn't. It's pretty obvious what the temptation in this part of the story is. The demon comes to Jesus and he offers him just raw, potent power. "I'll give you the kingdoms of the world in their splendor." That is power. And the question of whether this kind of power is actually the demon's to offer or not, aside, you would think that power over the kingdoms of the world in the hands of Jesus would be a formula for a better world. That kind of follows, doesn't it? I'm thinking about what we prayed about, what Trevor was talking about this morning. Use the logic that you're surrounded by. Put it into this story. Think about human trafficking. The curious thing about the story is that Jesus treats the offer as something to be shunned, something to be aggressively resisted. And I wonder if maybe a really quick survey of the recent history of the church in the Western world might give us a clue about why that is. We live, in our day, we live at a time when people are leaving the or- organized church, certainly, the institutional church, in droves, in unprecedented volume in our history as a Western culture. And because of what I do day by day, I get to hear their stories all the time. And a lot of the stories start out with something like, I grew up going to church, but. And then following the but, I hear story after story about the abuse of power. I hear story after story about the abuse of religious power, of political power, of financial power, of moral and spiritual power, of sexual power. I had this conversation about 2 weeks ago with this young woman who, I knew she wasn't from Winnipeg, and I just said, you know, what brought you here? How come you're in Winnipeg? And she said, well, I'm escaping a cult. And if you'd been in the situation and you could have seen her, you would have found that believable, just by other aspects of her presentation of herself. And so I said, well, you know, do you want to talk about that? You want to tell me a little bit more about your story? And she did want to tell me. And so she starts describing the cult that she's escaping from. And I'm listening to her story, and I'm thinking, God have mercy, she's describing a normal church. Except that in this church, the pastor had almost unmitigated power over the congregants. This woman is on what will be a very long road of recovery. It's a very curious thing to sit as a pastor with somebody that needs to be deprogrammed from a version of Christianity so that they can follow Jesus with freedom. I'm telling you, there's a little tension in that. It's easy to believe that having power, provided that it's used in the service of God and our fellow human beings, is a good thing. That's not like some kind of massive logical leap to believe that. It is worth remembering, though, that it's under just that kind of thinking that power used in the service of God and humanity is a good thing, categorically. It's worth remembering that under that kind of thinking, the Crusades took place. It's worth remembering that it's under that line of thought that the Inquisitions were launched. It's worth remembering closer to home that it's under that same logic that we pink-faced folks attempted to civilize those savage First Nations people in all sorts of settings. Historically, all kinds of positions of influence have been sought, religious palaces, splendid churches, these incredibly opulent ministry centers, in some cases, have been built under this kind of logic. And there's been a lot of what I would just sum up as moral chicanery that's happened under this. Now, that's a fairly bleak characterization of power wielded in the name of God, and I realize that any circumstance has different perspectives, and that's just one. But I think it's fair to say that whenever we look at a great division, a breakdown, or a crisis in the history of the church, one of the easily visible hallmarks of those events is the way that power has been exercised by those that claim to be followers of Jesus. I don't think that's an unfair summary. And the irony is that Jesus is offered to us in Jesus' own story as someone that emptied himself and became as we are. And when that the broader context for as we are assumes a couple of things in those stories, it assumes poor and it assumes powerless. I realize that as a person living in the West, I won the birth lottery, you know. I'm not powerless in this globe. Never mind that I'm a white-skinned male. Didn't ask for those either, but there you go. If I was a little taller, I'd be even more powerful statistically. I think it's easy to see the problem, you know, the way I just described it, and it's easy to throw stones from wherever we are. But power is still, I mean, even when you describe it that way, even having characterized it so negatively, there's still something about it. You just kind of go, yeah, but think of what we could do. And it's easy to see what's tempting about power. Which for me, anyway, leads me to a question. Surprise. It leads me to the question, why? Why is it? When we can look at the impact of power wielded in the name of God by those who claim to be followers of God, and it's incredible stories of destruction that are spilled out of that wielding, and still go, yeah, but. So where's that? What's driving the yeah, but? I wonder if maybe it could be that it's because power offers an easy substitute for the harder task of love. I wonder if maybe we find it easier to be God than to love God. I wonder if we find it easier to control people than to love them. I wonder if we find it easier to try to own life than we do to actually love life. See, in the biblical story, when Jesus wants to ask a question of pivotal importance, and we've been in this terrain the last couple of times, we've talked about these temptations, when he wants to ask the most important question that he can, the question that he asks is, do you love me? It's interesting that if we kept going in Matthew for a few more chapters, we'd find the disciples in the same story asking the question, can we sit at your right hand and your left hand in the kingdom? You know? Yeah, I know, love, that's great, but who gets to be in charge? It sort of seems to be built in, this challenge. But it seems to me like ever since the part of the story that's described for us in Genesis 3, which we will get to eventually in our other series, well, Trevor's going to go there next week, actually, as part of his grand survey of Genesis. So brace yourselves for that. But it seems like ever since that part of the story where the serpent says, this day you're going to eat of the tree and your eyes are going to be opened and you're going to be like gods, you're going to know good from evil. It seems like ever since that part of the story, we've been tempted to replace love with power. And the temptation is never more powerful than when we ourselves don't know how to give and receive love. When we find intimacy challenging, the handy default is power. That's way easier to access. It's right there. Haven't read the book, but I heard an interview with the author. It made me want to read the book. It's on a list of mine somewhere. The book is called Snakes with Suits. It's an examination of the way the culture of corporate leadership rewards unethical behavior and dysfunction. Pretty fascinating expose of what gets rewarded when it comes to the exercise of power in our culture. It's easy to go to this. When we find ourselves threatened by intimacy, it's easier to default to power. I want us to go back to the story of Jesus and Peter because that's a story in which Jesus offers one of these kind of enigmatic Eastern sayings of his that kind of turns this whole broken picture of why power is good on its head. And the context is one that we've been in before, Jesus asking Peter three times, do you love me? Do you love me more than these? Do you love me? And kind of once for every betrayal. There's this beautiful poetic symmetry about this conversation that Jesus has with Peter. And then, having heard Peter's response, commissions him three times. Says, you go and love others. Go and feed my sheep. Go take care of my people. And then, having commissioned Peter, he says this strange thing to him. Listen to this. This is John 21, 18. In all truth, I tell you, when you were young, you put on your belt and walked where you liked. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands, and somebody else will put a belt around you and take you where you would rather not go. It's like this Yoda moment that Jesus just rolls out, you know? Nice. Now, what were we talking about again? Just, you know, we forget that Jesus isn't a light-skinned, light-haired, blue-eyed, Western-brained person. Moments like this in the story are good reminders. These are the words from Jesus that invert the belief about what it means to grow up and become powerful that we are surrounded by. See, our culture says it this way. Our culture says, when you were young, you were dependent. And you couldn't go where you wanted to go. You couldn't go your own way. But when you grow up, you're going to be able to make your own decisions. You're going to be able to go your own way. You're going to be able to control your own destiny. That's what it means to mature. That's what you're aimed at. And Jesus just has this completely different picture of maturity. The way Jesus tells the story of what it means to grow up, to be mature, is to have a combination of ability and willingness to be led where you would rather not go. Don't miss the context. Because the context is Jesus has no sooner given Peter his life calling. He's no sooner said, you are the kind of guy that the kingdom is going to be built by. Then he says to him, right hard on the heels of that, by the way, the path to being a world changer in the kingdom of God kind is actually the path of downward mobility, not the path of upward mobility that the culture makes so much of. The path to being a world changer of the kingdom of God kind is the path that leads us more and more to being able to behave what it means to constantly abandon power in favor of love. My dad, whom we've been praying for, whose treatment is going very well in early stages, thank you for your prayers. My dad's a guy who showed me this. This is a guy who moved to a small northern community for work opportunity. Somebody who believed that being part of the community of faith really mattered, and when there wasn't an expression of the community of faith in that little northern town that felt like a good cultural fit, just promptly went and found some like-minded people and started to gather, started a church, alongside earning a living. And so was a very natural leader in that community for all the years that I lived at home. And then about a decade or so after I no longer lived there, he continued in leadership in that community. He described a situation to me in which the core leadership group, the board in this case, of this church, was in conflict about something. And there had been sort of an ongoing issue with this leadership team. And it was becoming contentious. And in particular, there were some individuals who were starting to push on one another in ways that, from my dad's point of view, were not filled with the right things. They weren't about love. They were about power. And so the conversation he had with me was him wrestling out loud with the question, his own internal question, about whether or not he should resign from that leadership group. And for him, the question of resignation was not a question of political power. It wasn't, if I can't play marbles by my rules, I'm not going to play. It wasn't schoolyard behavior. For him, the linchpin was the question of how he could best love the people in that story. And if being tangled up in the organizational reality made it harder for him to love them well, he just wasn't interested. He did resign. And as the story played out, that decision, I think, was an important one in many people's lives in that story. And that's lovely. And those kind of decisions don't come with any sort of guarantee that that's how they'll play. But that's an extremely concrete story from my memory of what it means to exchange power for love. It's an easily visible illustration of that. So when Jesus talks about this, it's important to remember he's not describing, when he says things like this little story about who gets you dressed and where you go, he's not talking about being spineless. He's not talking about becoming a passive victim of the manipulation of our milieu. That is not the point of the illustration at all. He's not talking about becoming somebody who gets walked on by everyone around them. He is talking about being a people who have a growing understanding that maturity means learning how to be led. And that means learning how to surrender. Now, I don't know about you, but I know when I hear somebody say surrender in church, I get nervous, categorically. Because I have, in my collective memory of religious experience, I embraced for some version or other of an altar call. I embraced, if that's not an altar call kind of environment that we're in. Michael, it's okay, I'm not going to do an altar call. I'm braced, if not for an altar call, then at least for some serious guilt-laden manipulation, you know? Somebody's just going to ratchet up this give it all to Jesus thing and sing 30 verses of that song. I know who grew up where I grew up, right there. This is not what Jesus is talking about in this story, and it's not what I'm talking about either, for that matter. And I wondered, I was wrestling with this week, I thought, how do you... Because lots of us grew up religious, you know, lots of us grew up with this big lever around this idea of surrender. I was just trying to think, now, how can we open this in a way that goes around the end of that, to what I think Jesus is actually trying to get at? And as it turns out, I've been reading a book that I was given to give to somebody else that I still have. They know. Lisa gave me a copy of Gabor Mate's book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, a book about addiction. Fabulous book, by the way. If you're a person who has, let's call them addictive tendencies because they have lots of shapes, or you deal with or love someone who's an addict, and you haven't read this book, this is my plug. Gabor did not put me up to this. Okay, this is just me reading the book and going, holy smokes, everybody that loves with, lives with, is an addict needs to read this book. And unbelievably honest, like rendingly honest book. Not least of all because Mate is himself, although he's a doctor who works with drug addicts, the kind of the most desperate of drug addicts in our culture, the folks who form the community at East Hastings in Vancouver. A place worth walking through, just don't do it at night. Despite the fact that that's his life work as a medical doctor, he is himself an addict. And his addiction is what he calls a white glove addiction. He is addicted, and this sounds funny when you say it fast, but he's addicted to classical music. And when he describes his behavior around having classical music, purchasing it, owning it, and the way it controls him, you realize, no, this is his understanding that he is like the people he serves actually makes a lot of sense. And it changes the picture of what you think of when you think about addiction. Anyway, at one point in this book, Mate tells the story of his own first visit to a 12-step group, to an AA group. And as soon as I read this, it was just all kinds of resonance for me, because my picture of what it means to be a disciple, to be a follower of Jesus, changed, I would say, as profoundly under the influence of my friends that are in recovery as under any other mentor in my life. It's in the recovery community that I have encountered the things that have the deepest, richest savor of following to me that I've hit anywhere in my life. If there are addicts, drug and chemical addicts, alcohol addicts that I love, it's not heroic. Like, I'm not loving them because I'm some kind of great lover of the least of these. I'm loving them because I'm looking for great examples. And these people just teach me stuff over and over and over again. So, when I hit this part of Mate's story, it just went poof for me. And I thought, here's a way, here might be a way, to get around the end of our religious hang-up about, if we have one, about the idea of surrender. I'm going to read us a longish section, but it's story, so it'll be okay. Mate is in this AA meeting. He's wrestling with his own ego. At this point, he's already a well-known writer, speaker, leader in the field of addiction, somebody who treats addicts.
And he showed up at an AA meeting, but not because he's the guest speaker. He just showed up because he's an addict. And so he's like, am I going to be recognized? I kind of want to be, but I kind of don't want to be. So he's kind of got this whole thing going on inside of him. And if you've ever been to an AA meeting or a 12-step meeting, you know that part of what characterizes those gatherings is storytelling. And man, some of these people are great storytellers. Anyway, so he just relates what happens. And I'm just going to read you this section of the story. So this person gets up, introduces themselves, and people are introducing themselves, and there's cheering, you know, everybody's like made welcome. Anyway, gracious experience. So this person gets up and they begin this way, welcome all. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Mate thinks, first I have to start drinking. We're here to surrender, to let go of the old ideas that keep us stuck. I don't do surrender. I'm not even sure what that means. As if in response to my inner commentator, a tall, burly man strides to the lectern. He has a thick nose, and his oiled hair is slicked back into a ducktail. Looking at him, you feel you'd want to avoid him on a dark street. He speaks with the authority of someone who's looked himself in the eye without blinking. I'm Peter, alcoholic. Hi, Peter, a loud chorus responds. I'm here to tell you about surrender. He begins. I'm here to tell you how hip, slick, cool I was when I first came to AA. You wouldn't believe how slick and cool. Snickers all around. Anything I wanted, I could get with my mouth, and if I couldn't, I'd take it with my fists. I robbed my own mother once. That still hurts. When I first came here, all I wanted was to sober up enough so I could concentrate on my flourishing drug business. My last binge, 6 years ago, ended with 3 days in the bathroom where I kept puking, sweating, and shitting myself. I didn't dare be more than a few feet away from the toilet or the shower. Boisterous laughter all around the room. After 3 days of bathroom living, I reconnected the phone. Three messages. The first was from my landlord. Peter, you're evicted. The second was from my mother. Peter, you can heal. The third was from my friend. Peter, I've surrendered, and it works. It's lining up perfect, I thought. If that jerk can surrender, so can I. I was still in my better than phase. I don't know if you're familiar with 12-step work at all, but until you get past the measuring of yourself against others and deciding you're better than someone, nothing happens. Nods of recognition, guffaws, and applause. I looked around and asked myself what surrender would look like. In my case, it looked like a large green Glad garbage bag into which I gathered all my drug paraphernalia along with my little phone book of business contacts. Wouldn't need them anymore. Chucked them all into a bin in the back alley. Gumber says, I'm struck by that. Ah, surrender is not some abstract, airy-fairy, spiritual concept. It's individual and it's practical. At the same time, I do feel like a voyeur here. My life and this man's cannot be measured on the same scale of suffering. I envy his serenity, humility, and air of quiet command. Thus speaks the automatic, mechanical voice of self-judgment in my mind. Peter takes up his story again. Now my goal, he says, is only that each day I should become closer to the God that I understand. The greatest teaching I have received is that I can be happy without imposing my will on you or you or anyone else, even if I feel like doing so. You may not believe you can surrender, but as you do, there will be a shift. You'll know there's a shift because your heart changes. As you study the big book and you serve people and help the community, your heart softens. That's the greatest gift. A soft heart. I wouldn't have believed it. Yes. Soft heart, Gabor thinks. How quickly my heart hardens and how brittle a hard heart can be. The last speaker is Elaine, alcoholic. Hi, Elaine. In the eyes of the newcomers, she begins, I see sadness, hunger, desperation. How will I ever have a life again? How will I get money? How will I build a relationship? Not my problems, I think. Still, I wonder, what would she see in my eyes? Nothing's going to happen overnight for most of you. It took me a long time of coming to these meetings before I could hear anything. And that didn't sit well with me. Two things alcoholics hate is work and time. There has to be no effort involved,
then you want the results right away. Chuckles and applause. Mate writes, that's me. I resist emotional work and I do want immediate results. A sense of urgency typifies attention deficit disorder, I wrote in my book, Scattered Minds. A desperation to have immediately whatever it is that one may desire at the moment, be it an object, an activity, or a relationship. If it doesn't happen quickly for me, I feel like bailing, and unless I'm extraordinarily motivated, I often do. I used to be a militant party girl, Elaine continues in her Lorraine Bacall voice, auburn dyed bangs falling over her forehead above large, heavily painted eyes. I wasn't going to take anything seriously except having a good time, and that meant being stone drunk. Three things didn't help me at all were love, education, and punishment. I didn't learn, no matter how hard people tried to love me, no matter what facts I knew, and no matter how many times life taught me harsh lessons, I didn't learn until I began to listen. The first time I listened was at an AA meeting in Toronto. A native man in his 60s was speaking. He said, I've been sober for 2 years now, and 6 months ago I got my first job. If I'd known how good it felt to work, I would have been done with drinking long ago. 5 months ago, I got my own place. Had I known how good that was, I would have gone sober long ago. 3 months ago, I got myself a girlfriend. Boy, if I'd known how great that was, I might never have drank in the first place. Merriment chortles, clapping of appreciative hands. Now I'm 64, the man said, and I've just been told I have cancer. I have 6 months to live. Elaine pauses to look around the room as we take in this information. Silently, we wait for her conclusion. I thought he was going to announce, I'm off to the biggest 6 month drunk you can imagine, so the hell with you all and goodbye. That's what I would have done with the death sentence hanging over me, but not this native man. I'm just so grateful, he said. So thankful that I'm sober, that I've had 2 years of sobriety, and that I can look forward to the rest of my life in sobriety. That's when I got that sobriety is more than just the absence of alcohol. It's a way of being. It's living life in its fullness. Do I have to become an alcoholic, lose everything, puke my guts out, and then get religion before I can experience the fullness of life, whatever the hell that means? I'm resentful. No, I'm anxious, fearful that it will never happen for me. That's what Elaine would have seen in my eyes, or did see. Perhaps I was the newcomer she was talking about. Elaine is about to leave the lectern amidst nods of approval, but she steps back to the microphone once more. I don't mean, she says, that my life is perfect. Sometimes it feels like things are completely falling apart, like this week. But I no longer confuse stuff that happens with my life. This moment is okay, even when things are coming apart at the seams. Right here, right now, at this moment, things are okay. Forget your life situation for a while and pay attention to your life, writes the spiritual teacher Eckhart Tolle. Your life situation exists in time. Your life is now. Mate says, I've read his book over and over. I've underlined that phrase and I understand it intellectually. This woman, Elaine, didn't only understand it, she gets it. It's a truth she's discovered for herself. Surrender is the key, says Elaine. Elaine, even now, whenever I try too hard, I mess it all up. Don't try. Just listen to God's directions. Galbraith, at this point in the book, launches off into his own spiritual struggle for a paragraph or two. Starts with, fuck that God thing again. And then he's just off on this rant about how either God can't be all three things that many people claim God is. God can't be all-loving, all-knowing, and all-powerful. Pick two of the three, but you can't have all three. It just doesn't work. He tells his own story about almost losing his life as an infant. He's a Hungarian Jew as an infant in the Budapest ghetto. His grandparents died in the death camps. He's got reasons to doubt the goodness slash power slash love combination. But then he kind of gets to past this moment of rebellion, as he describes it, and says, I know better. I know better. I shouldn't get stuck right here because what Peter has clearly said is to God, I understand. For Mate, that's truth in essence. That's a voice from the inside.
That's his starting point. It was very interesting when I mentioned this book in that booth where I also do some work. One of the profs there came up to me afterwards and said, he says, I know Gabor. This guy knows lots of people. He's always surprising me. I'm like, well, what's the context? Turns out this prof's daughter is a nurse who works with Gabor Maté in East Vancouver and has for decades. And so he knows him personally. He says, quirky guy. Yeah, no kidding. He says, you know who Gabor Maté reads? I'm like, nope. He reads the Apostle Paul. It's fascinating, eh? The reason I wanted to read the stories is because I think Maté nails something about the idea of surrender when he says, he kind of has this moment of clarity, and he says that surrender is not some abstract, airy-fairy spiritual concept. It's individual, and it's practical. And maybe this is part of why there's something inside of me that just goes off in rebellion, my own little internal, when I hear about surrender in church. Maybe it's because so often, for me, growing up, that word got delivered in the context of all sorts of predetermined definitions about exactly who God is, how surrender to God should look. So basically, somebody else gave me a list of what should go in the green garbage bag of my life, and a prescription for exactly what a surrendered life would look like on the other side of the event of surrender. And that's just never washed. But what, for me anyway, but what if the key to Jesus' picture of what surrender looks like is actually found in the words of Jesus himself, the words that we just looked at a few moments ago? What if Jesus is saying that surrender is being willing to have God dress us, being willing to have God clothe us in our true identity without all the self-protective, I'm in control here, I have the power here, guises that we often put on to buffer all sorts of things. To buffer our own suffering, to buffer the stuff that's going off inside of us, to buffer the things that come at us from the outside that hurt. If I can put together an identity that I control, I live with the perception that I've reduced my vulnerability. That's a lie, but it's an easy one to grab. And I think it's built right into the lie that happens in that same moment in the Genesis story where the snake comes to these people and says, you know what, the problem is that God might not love you. The problem is that you can't trust him. You got to see with more clarity to see it, but if you just go down this path, you'll get your clarity and that'll help. What if what Jesus is talking about when he talks about surrender, what if the reason Jesus pushes the offer of incredible power away with the aggression that he does is because he knows that unless we learn to be those who can be led by God, unless we learn what it means to surrender, to go to places that we don't naturally, if you will, want to go, we never get to grow up into having God clothe us with our true identity. We never get to live like we're unafraid. The essence of being led where we don't want to go is letting God lead us to places where God is in control rather than places where we are in control. Peter, the character, the first storyteller in Maté's book, says it this way. He said, now my goal is only that each day I get to know God better. Now my goal is only that each day I should become closer to the God that I understand. The greatest teaching I have received is that I can be happy without imposing my will on you or anyone else, even when I feel like doing so. I don't need to impose my will to be all right. But I'm not going to learn that unless I learn to choose to divest myself of power in favor of love. And the other thing I love about Peter as a storyteller is the dynamic language that he uses when he says right after that, you may not believe you can surrender. And what Peter's describing becomes clear in the next phrase. He's saying, you may not believe that you can face the event called in or out surrender. I'm surrendered, I'm not surrendered. Like a line, you have to be on one side or the other. You may not believe that you can surrender, but listen to this. But as you do,
there will be a shift. You'll know there's a shift because your heart changes. And he goes on to talk about how it becomes soft. What I love about the words that he chooses as this writer relates them to us is that there is something incredibly dynamic about the idea of surrender. Surrender is something we learn to do. It's not airy-fairy, vaguely spiritual. It's practical. It's as practical as Peter's garbage bag of stuff. And it's as moment by moment as that too. It's as decision by decision as that too. This is not the least of the reasons why the season of Lent exists and has endured in the history of the church, folks. It's because it's the kind of season where for a time we together take on the small sorts of things that put us off balance in ways that have the shape of surrender about them. Peter, the recovering addict, knows, as any recovering addict does, that surrender is comprised of many small surrenders, but real, practical, actual ones. And that unfolds increasingly into a tender-hearted life of surrender. We keep bouncing back in the wrong direction, you know. But the more we know what it's like to live life with a soft heart, the more we know what it's like to live with the heart of Jesus beating in us, the more when we fall back into having that other hard, brittle heart, the less we like it there. And the good news the saints teach us is that over time, as we learn to surrender, we can also learn how lovely it is to live that way. And the lie that we've been operating on, the lie that says that power is actually the way to self-secure, that power is actually the way to also secure our environment, and subsequently to secure a good world, that we start to recognize the fallacy in that. And we start to live differently in these little moments. Having a conversation, as people of my vintage sometimes do with their peers, about exercise the other day, and this person said, "So I heard this guy on the radio had this great saying. He said, some is good, more is better, everything counts." Maybe you've heard that. It seems to be a bit of an exercise mantra these days, an attempt to get us moving. I didn't like it until the end. I didn't like the logic of, if some is good, more must be better. Because in the end, this is just a problem. Good, now I can be addicted to exercise. If I had those tendencies. But I really liked the rebalance of everything counts. And that somehow made the whole phrase workable for me when I thought about it in the context of change. There's something deeply true about those ideas. They may not extend to their ultimate end cleanly. Pithy sayings rarely do. But there's still something good in there. And when it comes to surrender, one of the reasons we practice the sort of things that we do, whether it's in Lent or in some other season or in our everyday life, is because that's how we shape. That's how we become a different shape. That's how we change. Not by some vague spiritualization of becoming like Jesus and thinking about it a lot. This actually happens pretty much on the ground. Jesus knows that, and that's why he pushes away the shape of power that says the way to a better world is actually to get a grip on it and control it. And instead says, no, actually the way to a better world is to learn what it means to be controlled. To put ourselves, moment by moment, in the hands of the God who loves us and who knows and can give us, dress us in our true identity. And then in that identity, we can go into the world. And in that identity, we can choose to give up power for love. Over and over and over again. And that kind of behavior is what carries the truth about Jesus into the world. In everyday, practical kinds of ways, the kind of ways that actually make a difference to the world that we live in.